This is VOA News via remote. I'm Diane Roberts. Millions of Christians around the world celebrated a second Easter under coronavirus restrictions Sunday, with Pope Francis calling for vaccines to be shared among the poorest nations as COVID-19 surges. Despite vaccine rollouts gathering pace in many richer countries, dramatic spikes in cases have seen deeply unpopular restrictions enforced from Canada to Europe and South America. Vaccination was an essential tool in the fight against the virus, the Pope said in his Easter Sunday address, with Italy under a strict lockdown over the weekend. Stricter curbs have come into effect in Belgium as well as in France, where authorities are scrambling to deal with a serious spike in cases that has overwhelmed hospitals in Paris. And celebrations have been damaged in South America, too, where Brazil is in the grip of a devastating outbreak, likely fueled by a more contagious variant. The worrying situation led Peru to go into an Easter lockdown, Bolivia to seal the frontier with Brazil, and Chile to close all borders. But in Jerusalem, curbs have been partially lifted due to Israel's successful vaccination campaign, allowing Easter celebrations to go ahead. India's richest state, Maharashtra, announced stringent COVID-19 restrictions starting Monday after a rapid rise in infections, now accounting for more than half the country's daily new cases. The state will shut shopping malls, cinema, bars, restaurants, and places of worship as of Monday evening. Authorities will also impose a complete lockdown on weekends, a minister in the state government told reporters. Germany will place the Netherlands among countries classified as high-risk zones due to elevated numbers of COVID-19 cases, that according to Berlin's Infectious Disease Agency. This is VOA News. A maintenance worker whose runaway truck sparked Taiwan's worst rail disaster in recent decades made a tearful apology Sunday, as investigators said the train driver had little time to react to the collision. At least 50 people have died and more than 200 were injured in Friday's crash, which sent a packed 8-car train hurtling into the sides of a narrow tunnel. Investigators say the train hit a truck on the line moments before it entered the tunnel. The vehicle slipped down a steep embankment, and prosecutors are working to determine whether the driver either failed to secure the parking brake or if it suffered a mechanical failure. The manager of the construction site, who owned the truck, accepted responsibility for the disaster Sunday, as did the transport minister, although his offer to resign was rejected for now. At least 22 members of Indian security forces were killed in a central Indian state by Maoist fighters, officials said Sunday, one of the bloodiest attacks by the extreme left-wing insurgent groups this year. Security personnel belonging to the Central Reserve Police Force's Elite Cobra Unit, the District Reserve Guard, and the Special Task Force were attacked Saturday during an anti-insurgency operation. Opponents of military rule in Myanmar inscribed messages of protest on Easter eggs Sunday, while thousands of others were back to the streets denouncing a February 1st coup and facing off with the security forces who shot and killed at least 3 men. In the latest in a series of impromptu shows of defiance, messages including Spring Revolution, We Must Win, and Get Out MAH, referring to junta leader Min Aung Hlaing, were seen on eggs and photographs on social media. Crowds have come into the streets day and night despite a bloody crackdown and roundups of activist leaders to reject the return of military rule after a decade of tentative steps towards democracy. Palestinian election officials announced Sunday 36 candidate lists had been approved to run in legislative elections set for next month, the first Palestinian polls in 15 years. The vote is part of an effort by the dominant Palestinian movements, Fatah Secularist and Hamas Islamist, to boost international support for Palestinian governance. European Council President Charles Michel arrived in Tripoli Sunday as Libya seeks to build a unity government and end a decade of chaos following a NATO-backed 2011 revolt. No details have been released of Michel's visit, which comes as Libyan leaders try to move towards reconciliation in a UN-backed peace process. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
We are asking to ECOWAS to tell him to implement the decision and to listen from his people. We are part of his people, and he's the head of state of all of us as Beninese. He should not understand only or listen only. He's a supporter.
A former top diplomat warns of an imminent constitutional crisis before Benin's April 11 presidential election.
The opposition leaders have basically seen all of these things, and they love their country. They know that it is now worth supporting a president or a government who is not in the interest of the people, who is not living up to the promises that he made during the campaign period.
A senior opposition party member says the group is working hard to ensure incumbent Liberian President George Weah becomes a one-term president.
It was a need for us, the political leaders, to see that the electoral code resembles the aspirations of Cameroonians in general. We are living in a country where democracy is not implemented. They don't want political leaders to hold meetings, and they always come to disrupt.
And Cameroonian police disperse opposition leaders' meeting that seeks to demand democratic reforms in the Central African country. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Benin, a former top diplomat is warning of an imminent constitutional crisis before the West African country's April 11 presidential election. Ambassador Rogatien Biao, a former Beninese foreign minister, is also calling on the international community to pressure the administration in Cotonou and the Electoral Commission to respect the constitution. This after arguing that the presidential election should be held before April 5, 2021, which he says is the date incumbent President Patrice Talon's official first term expires. His remarks come after opposition and civil society groups say the presidential election will be illegal because it will come after the president's term has expired. But supporters of the president have rejected the criticism, saying some of the opposition groups are desperate after their own candidate failed to qualify for the election. They are calling on citizens to go to the polls to perform their civic duty and elect a new president next week. Ambassador Rogatien Biao tells me that the vote might not take place. He says the elections could be stopped by opposition plans for nationwide protest against what he says is a poll that sharply contravenes the constitution.
My view is very clear. We should sit together around the table to negotiate new text for the election, because the current text excludes the majority of people who would like to run for the presidential. This is why we are saying that is not correct to organize this election on April 11. The date they choose to call people for the election to go to vote, it is 1 week after the end of his mandate. His mandate expires on April 5th. It is a violation of our constitution to organize election after the end of the mandate of the president. They should organize this election before the end of his mandate to allow the re-elected president or the new president to the transfer of power to the elected president.
Well, in your recent opinion piece that was published here in Washington, D.C., you said Benin's democracy is being undone and for the international community to take a stand. What do you mean the Benin's democratic tenets are being undone? Who is doing it?
It is the current power, the current head of state. They modify the constitution without consensus process. They modify the charts of political parties without consensus. They modify the electoral code without consensus. And they took several laws to exclude all other parties without any consultation. It is a big problem concerning our democracy, because since 1990, we work on the basis of the consensus. And consensus is a principle of our constitution.
But next week, yes, Beninese go to the polls to elect a new president. Some people are suggesting incumbent President Patrice Talon will win re-election. Others are saying the elections will not be free or fair. What are your thoughts?
The election, no, it is a dream of some persons think that the election will take place on April 11. In my view and my feeling, this election will not take place on April 11 because start by April 5th, we have no power to impose anything to any person in our country. And we are sure that our people will demonstrate his capacity to take the power we give him on April 6, 2016. We are now on April 2021. We have a mandate of 5 years. We are at the end of the 5 years, and starting by April 6, it is a new era. This new era is on the hand of our people.
You called on the international community to scrutinize what is going on in Benin. But what can the international community do at this moment?
The international community should talk to the current chairman to follow the decision taken by the African Court on human rights and people, because they ask him to return back to the constitution we adopted on December 11, 1990, and to organize election on this basis, not on the basis of his own constitution he adopted on November 2019. It is what we are asking for the international community, to push pressure on him to implement the decision of African Court on human rights and people. It is what we are asking to the ECOWAS, to tell him to implement the decision and to listen from his people. We are part of his people, and is the head of state of all of us as Beninese. He should not understand only or listen only his supporters.
Ambassador Rogatien Biao is a former top diplomat. He spoke with me from the Beninese capital, Cotonou. In Liberia, the National General Secretary of the Opposition Unity Party says the group is working hard to ensure incumbent President George Weah becomes a one-term president. Mohamed Ali says the government has failed to improve the living standards of Liberians, and he says the administration has also failed to deal with allegations of corruption and amassing of wealth by the president and senior officials. But critics say the Unity Party is partly to blame for the alleged failure of the administration, citing endorsements leaders of the party gave to then-opposition leader Weah. Mr. Weah, an international soccer star, defeated then-incumbent Vice President Joseph Boakai in a runoff with 61.5% of the total vote cast. Ali's remarks come after his party joined other opposition groups that campaigned to defeat constitutional amendment in a referendum. They aim to reduce presidential and lower house term limit from 6 to 5 years, while those of the senators would have been reduced from 9 to 7 years. Critics say the amendment, which were backed by the president, would pave way for him to seek a third term, an assertion supporters deny. Mohamed Ali tells me that President Weah has failed to keep his promises, which he says is the reason why his popularity has slumped.
Basically, I campaigned against all of the propositions in the referendum, not because we didn't want it, but because there wasn't sufficient awareness created, there wasn't sufficient education, and the citizens of Liberia did not understand the implications, the advantages and disadvantages of all of the propositions that were inserted in the referendum. Additionally, we did not understand what it would mean by reducing the presidential term from 6 years to 5 years. And so we voted against it, we campaigned against it, and the Liberian people listened to the opposition. It shows that we were not prepared for the referendum. It shows that next time when we are engaging into a process of having a referendum, we should abide by the laws, give sufficient information to our people and educate them sufficiently so that they can understand what it will mean to change the constitution or to amend the constitution.
But some people argue that you just opposed for opposition's sake and did not negotiate with the government or did not engage the government to try to address some of your concerns in the run-up to the referendum. How do you respond to that?
That information is absolutely wrong. We did engage the government. As a matter of fact, we wrote several communications to the government and we even communicated with the National Elections Commission in order to have a roundtable discussions on how to proceed with the propositions in the referendum. We were not listened to. We even took the case to the Supreme Court of Liberia. We argued first that the propositions were bundled, 8 propositions into 3. The Supreme Court listened to us. We also filed a bill of information that because now the propositions were being unpacked or unbundled, we need a 1-year period to provide education for our people. We need a 1-year period to provide sufficient awareness. And the government did not listen to us. So as a matter of fact, from the Unity Party, the entire idea of the referendum started from our administration. So there was no need to have opposed it, but we wanted things done the right way.
Ms. Ali, some people also say that the opposition was not upfront with Liberians by arguing in some instances that the amendment to the constitution would have enabled President Weah to sit more than 2 terms in office. Do you think the accusations are justified?
Well, like I said from the beginning, there was a whole lot of confusion around this particular proposition by reducing the term of the presidency from 6 to 5 years. And we needed to have clear understanding on that. We needed to have a proper discussion with the government to come up to a single conclusion. But again, when this issue was raised, the government decided not to listen to us. And so we did not have the understanding. The lawyers were all interpreting that in a very different ways. And we were depending on the lawyers. We were depending on the courts. We were depending on the government to have a conversation in order to come up with a conclusion on what this will mean. So we did not have that understanding and we could not have ventured into supporting a proposition that would definitely cause chaos into the country. You know, make President Weah to say he wants a third term. But let me say this very quickly. We do not even believe that President Weah is going to get a second term. We are going to work very hard to ensure that he becomes a one-term president.
Analysts say there were clear evidence that some leaders of your party supported Weah when he was in opposition to become president. So what changed?
During the 2017 elections, people in opposition bloc in the second round decided to support Weah because they had thought that Mr. Weah was going to be a good president based on the promises he had made, based on the promise of change. But right after taking over the presidency, what we see in this was massive corruption, President Weah acquiring personal properties like never before, his ministers refusing to declare their assets, and they also acquiring properties. Civil servants have been deprived of taking salaries on time, and they've been marginalized, they've been silenced in their workplaces. So the opposition leaders have basically seen all of these things, and they love their country. They know that it is not worth supporting a president or a government who is not in the interest of the people, who is not living up to the promises that he made during the campaign period.
Muhammad Ali is the National General Secretary of the Liberian Opposition Unity Party. He spoke with me from the capital, Monrovia.
In Ivory Coast, supporters of the opposition Ivorian Popular Front say they have been vindicated following the acquittal of former President Laurent Gbagbo by the appeals court at the International Criminal Court, ICC. They have often rejected the charges against the former president, saying they were politically motivated and aimed at blunting Mr. Gbagbo's political appeal so he cannot seek re-election. This after the Hague-based court confirmed the former president's acquittal over charges including crimes against humanity. Mr. Gbagbo and former minister Charles Ble Goude, who served in his administration, were acquitted in 2019, but the ICC prosecutor appealed, arguing the acquittal was legally defective. Meanwhile, Amnesty International says the acquittal of both the former president and his former minister is disappointing to victims of Ivory Coast 2010-2011 post-election violence. Jean-Gervais Chide is the vice president of Gbagbo's opposition Ivorian Popular Front. He tells me supporters of the party are expecting the former president to return home in triumph.
For us, the members of his party, we would prefer that he comes here as soon as possible because we've been waiting for him for 10 years, and 10 years is too long. So we are expecting him to come now, maybe in April, in May, if that is possible, but we are waiting for him to make a decision by his own, on his own. As a member of his party, we remember that it took 10 years for the crisis to come to an end. It means that we remember that in 2011 and the 31st of March 2021, which means exactly 10 years, the International Criminal Court has freed him once for all. And we are very, very happy. And we are happy not only because we have succeeded, we have not given up. And it is due to Mr. Gbagbo, his resistance, because he has been able to resist and to support the situation for 10 years, which gives us the strength, the physical and moral strength to support also the situation.
Do you think the country is conducive enough for him to return? As some people suggest, that it might not be safe for him to return.
Well, this is something which we are thinking of, but we are here and the country is waiting for him. So if the ruling party, the government in power, cannot make sure that a citizen like Mr. Gbagbo cannot be in security, then it is a very, very big problem. But we think that the government will take every necessary measure to make his return as safe as possible.
But Jean-Gervais, the government has said that President Gbagbo is welcomed at any time. And now that the ICC has upheld his acquittal, people suggest that there should be no problem if he decides to return anytime he feels like it.
Yes. This is also my opinion. The head of state, Mr. Alassane Ouattara, has said that he was not opposed at all to Mr. Gbagbo's return. And then he was just waiting for the ICC to finish the problem of the appeal. Now that it is over, there's no reason why he should not be allowed to come. And besides, I think that the government itself, they will create a condition for his return. There should be no problem at all on this point.
Some people are suggesting that being away from Ivory Coast for the last 10 years, he might have lost his touch, his political touch, and he might not have the same influence he had. What is your assessment about that as his friend and as a leading member of his political party? Do you think he still has the political touch to challenge in future elections?
Of course he has. Those who are pretending that, are the person who don't know Mr. Gbagbo. They don't know President Gbagbo at all. He started his political career at the age of 18. He was 18 years old when he started political career. And he has gone under problems. And he always managed to come out. 10 years is nothing for him. I can tell you that he has kept in touch with his party, with the political situation in Cote d'Ivoire, even when he was in prison, because I went to see him in prison two times. And when he came out of prison in 2019, I went again to see him in Brussels. So he's a man who is completely aware of the situation, and he still has all his capacities, moral and mental capacities, in terms of political participation.
Jean-Gervais Tshiyide is the vice president of Gbagbo's opposition Ivorian Popular Front. He spoke with me from Ivory Coast commercial capital, Abidjan. In East Africa, the Counter-Extremism Project, a non-partisan international policy organization, has launched a report detailing the links between illicit trade, corruption, crime, and extremism in the region. Officials say the Counter-Extremism Project was established to combat the increasing threat of extremist ideologies globally. To learn more about the findings of the report and its recommendations, I reached the author, senior advisor, and spokesperson of the project, Sir Ivor Roberts.
The report investigates extremism, organized crime, and corruption in the East African region, which is a key security partner in the war on terror. And more specifically, it looks at the common denominator between these threats, what they all have in common, and which draws all these groups to the region, which is illicit trade. And illicit trade is attractive to these groups because it's lucrative, it's predictable compared with, say, hoping for money from ransom, and low risk as opposed to theft. So we've looked at the various components of this, terror groups such as Al-Shabaab and their affiliates in Somalia, Mozambique, as well as Central African militias, international crime groups, both in the East Asia and Latin America, are increasingly targeting East Africa as a destination market for illicit trade, as well as a transport hub for the mass import and export of illegal goods, including illegal wildlife trafficking, ivory, rhino horns, pangolin scales.
Did the report find or establish proof suggesting that East Africa's war against extremism, crime, and corruption is linked to illicit trade?
The report makes it clear that it is linked to illicit trade. The various recommendations we've made are all to try and strengthen regional cohesion, because while one country, say Kenya, has been in the forefront of trying to tackle these problems, if one country does it, but the its neighbouring countries are weak links in the chain, then the whole process is undermined. So it's very important that all the countries work together.
Talk to me about the key findings of this report.
Well, the key findings are that extremism, crime, illegal wildlife trade, illegal traffic in tobacco, in guns, are all linked, and as in the illegal smuggling also of consumer goods like sugar into Kenya. All these provide enormous funding opportunities for terrorist, extremist, and criminal groups, and of course opportunities for corruption in the administrations of the countries of the region. And so what I've suggested is, as I was saying, is that we should take measures to treat these equal evils threatening national security by a closer harmonization of legal penalties to try and deal, like Kenya has, with an interagency anti-illicit working group to bring together different strands of the government in dealing with this, and to insert much more stringent sentencing and penalties on traffickers throughout the region. I think good governance and transparent governance is the best bulwark against the illicit trade, which is doing so much damage to East Africa.
Well, Sir Robert, has the East African community or the countries along the East African region been so far successful in their battle against illicit trade?
I would say that they've been only partially successful. The East African Community Customs Union, it can only be as strong as its weakest link. And I think it should strengthen its control at important entry points like Mombasa Port and smaller airports. And it also must make harmonization of market standards the main priority in advancing integration. And that involves also proper factory inspections to make sure that counterfeit and illicit goods are not being produced at the expense of legal goods. And also you need stronger border security control, which has to go far beyond what we've seen so far. I think we have seen some very good examples. The Kenya Coast Guard Service, for instance, has done wonders at tackling the narcotics trade, but that simply encourages the smugglers to move along the coast away from the Kenyan coast onto adjacent coasts where they can carry out their work without too much harassment.
Sir Ivor Roberts is the report's author, senior advisor and spokesperson of the Counter-Extremism Project. He spoke with me from London. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. But first, for the second consecutive time, heavily armed police dispersed opposition leaders' meeting held to propose reforms they say are needed to democratically change the about 40-year rule of 88-year-old Cameroonian President Paul Biya. Opposition leaders, including three former presidential candidates, say the crackdown is the latest setback in their attempt to pave the way for a peaceful transition of power from Africa's second largest ruling president. For VOA, Moki Edward Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Seven opposition leaders said they were forcefully evicted from a meeting held in Yaoundé Wednesday as they were pressing for reforms to rescue elections from the strong grip of Cameroon's long-serving President Paul Biya. The leaders issued a formal statement on April 3. Among the attendees is Prince Michael Nguese Ekoso. He is the president of the opposition United Socialist Democratic Party and said he took part in the meeting with hopes of easing tensions after allegations of election rigging. Opposition leaders say post-election tensions rise after claims of fraud and are skewed towards Biya's Cameroon People's Democratic Movement Party.
It was a need for us, the political leaders, to see that the electoral code resembles the aspirations of Cameroonians in general. We are living in a country where democracy is not implemented. They don't want political leaders to hold meetings, and they always come to disrupt. And also, it was a need for us to be able to discuss those things that has hampered true democracy, and then talk about the need for opposition parties to be able to form a reasonable platform to address some of the key issues.
Ekoso said the leaders avoided brutality and assault by peacefully leaving the hall when the police ordered an immediate stop to the meeting. The government said it ordered the meeting to be interrupted because the opposition leaders failed to obtain an authorization as stipulated by Cameroonian law. Ekoso said the law requires an authorization only when there is a political rally. He said he and his peers were simply taking part in a meeting of seven opposition leaders. Three candidates who lost the country's October 7, 2018 presidential poll were in the meeting. Maurice Kamto, who claims he won the election and that Biya stole his victory, said the decision to stop an opposition meeting was another step in the crackdown on democratic process. Cabral Libby, a former presidential aspirant and lawmaker of the opposition Cameroon Party for National Reconciliation, and Joshua Osi, former presidential candidate and vice president of the Social Democratic Front, said the decision to stop the meeting was an affront to democracy. Cameroon's higher education minister under Biya, Jacques Famindrungu, says there is no need for changes in the electoral code now. He says Cameroonians gave Biya 71% of their votes in the 2018 presidential election, an indication that they agree with all of Biya's policies and laws. He says people are expecting Biya to concentrate on developing Cameroon in fulfillment of the promises he made before the 2018 presidential poll. Ndongo said political parties can make suggestions as to the changes they want in the electoral code for Cameroon's parliament to examine when lawmakers deem it necessary. Mamoun Joya is of the Cameroon Civil Society Group, which advocates for good governance in the country. He says any opposition bill to change the electoral code will be thrown out of parliament by majority lawmakers controlled by Biya. He says Biya and his Cameroon People's Democratic Movement Party have drifted from the policy and values they promised the Cameroon people when the party was founded in 1985. He says Biya and his party are not ready to enact laws that will stop election rigging and the siphoning of state funds. The 88-year-old Biya has been in power for over 40 years in Cameroon, 7 as prime minister and 38 as president. In 2008, he removed term limits from the constitution, allowing him to serve indefinitely. He has won all of Cameroon's elections, but the opposition has always contested his victory, saying Biya prepared the electoral code to favor him and his CPDM party. Biya is the second oldest serving president in sub-Saharan Africa after his neighbor Obiang Nguema of Equatorial Guinea, who has been in power since 1979. When Biya's new term is finished, he will be 93 years old. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
A Kenyan music producer is taking his work to remote villages to record up-and-coming artists on location to offer something new and different for Kenya's competitive music industry. For VOA, Juma Majanga caught up with producer Presta George in Awenda, Kenya, and filed this report.
Alex, can we record?
Kenyan music producer Presta George imagined how difficult it must be for village artists to get their songs on the radio, let alone become famous. And that's where George found his calling in the southwest town of Awendo. But the town of 16,000 people is not where he does most of his recordings.
I thought it wise to bring these studios to the local people so that at least they can compete or they can sell their products.
Every weekend, George packs all the equipment he needs to record complete albums on location in remote areas and hits the road. The country roads are inaccessible by car, so he travels by motorcycle, balancing instruments, a laptop, and recording equipment. From soloists to church choirs, this traveling producer's goal is to find music that otherwise wouldn't get distributed. In the remote village of Komolo Rume, George records the choir of Obama Seventh-day Adventist Church, named after the U.S. President Barack Obama, whose father was from Kenya.
I like that. You really tried that. So we are going to the next phase.
Choir leader Hoki Otieno says George has helped them record 4 albums, which would not have been possible otherwise in this village of less than 1,000 people.
This opportunity where we can get a studio where we are, it will make us to air out the good talents that we have, which could not be heard at all.
Making his clan's dream a reality can come at a cost for George, as many village artists cannot afford to pay for production.
Aya, let's join and then...
But George says it is worth the risk to discover up and coming talent that would otherwise get missed by Nairobi's big production houses. Jackson Rakama, known by his stage name Jagede, is a Nairobi recording artist and music producer.
If you want to be successful in the music business, you have to move to Nairobi, unfortunately. So the idea of moving studio, you know, that's a very brilliant idea. You take the studio to the people so that they can get that quality. We should do more of that so that we can empower the local artists so that they can get access to the, quality audios.
Kenya's music industry insider says success comes down to technology and the popularity of artists.
In fact, you have now prolonged properly. Thank you very much. I'll go and sit.
George says he is confident his traveling studio can get ahead of competition. Juma Majanga for VOA News, Awendo, Kenya.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's kick off with the African Champions League, where defending champions Al Ahly of Egypt needed an injury time equalizer against Al Merrikh of Sudan on Saturday to join Group A winners Simba Sports Club of Tanzania in the quarterfinals. Ahly earned a 2-2 draw away to El Merrikh and are now second in the group on 8 points with one group game left to play. Simba are Group A winners after securing their place in quarterfinals with a 4-1 win over DR Congo's AS Vita Club. 100,000 fans were allowed into Simba's stadium in Dar es Salaam. Vita Club's defeat follows another DR Congo's club, TP Mazembe, who were also eliminated on Friday. TP Mazembe, who are 5 times winners, were eliminated after losing 2-0 at CR Belouizdad of Algeria. Defeat left Mazembe bottom of Group B on just 2 points, with one round of games remaining. Many of Mazembe's players did not return in time from the Africa Cup of Nations duties. Earlier on Friday, already qualified Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa drew 0-0 away to El Hilal of Sudan in Omdurman in the same group. Sundowns have 13 points, Belouizdad 6, Hilal 4, and Mazembe 2 ahead of the final group matches next Friday. So far, Sundowns, Wydad Casablanca of Morocco, Esperance of Tunisia, Simba of Tanzania, and Alga of Algeria have reached the quarterfinals. The top 2 teams in each of the 4 groups qualify for the quarterfinals. Meanwhile, the abandoned qualifying game for the 2021 Africa Cup of Nations final between Sierra Leone and Benin will now be played in June, according to the Confederation of African Football, CAF. The Group L match was called off ahead of kickoff in Freetown on Tuesday after 5 Benin players received news they had tested positive for COVID-19 and would not be allowed to play. Benin questioned the veracity of those tests and refused to play. Benin only need to draw the match to qualify for the Cup of Nations in Cameroon in 2022, but if Sierra Leone win the game, they will qualify at Benin's expense as they have a better goal difference. And Cape Verde, Guinea-Bissau, Mauritania, and Ethiopia confirmed their places at next year's Africa Cup of Nations finals in Cameroon following the final round of qualifying matches on Tuesday. On Monday, Malawi also qualified after beating Uganda 1-0 in their final Group B qualifying match. Uganda was thus eliminated. Uganda's defeat means no East African nation has qualified, as Kenya and Tanzania were already eliminated. Burkina Faso finished with 12 points in the group after beating South Sudan 1-0 in Ouagadougou. Malawi were second with 10 points. All of Monday's other qualifiers had no bearing on qualification, but settled the placings in several groups. Egypt beat Comoros 4-0 to finish the campaign unbeaten, but both teams qualified from Group G, with Comoros qualifying for the first time. Defending champions Algeria beat Botswana 5-0 to top Group H, while Zambia beat Zimbabwe 2-0 in Harare, but Zimbabwe had already qualified, and the 2012 African champion Zambia were thus eliminated. Gabon and the Gambia advanced from Group D, although both lost their final games to Angola and DR Congo, respectively. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Just like that.
Oh, sure.
Just like that.
If any,
Sunday.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Bill Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a bald-headed man will not grow hair by getting excited. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.